Won't you be my neighbor? It's an invitation to help somebody know that they're loved and capable of loving. Love is at the root of everything. Love or the lack of it.
That's the whole idea of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which aired on PBS from 1968 to 2001. It may sound childish or simple to a cynic, but it can also be heard years after Fred Rogers' death as a critique of the vast majority of programming aimed at kids. Here he is defending public funding for PBS before Congress under the Nixon administration.
I think that it's much more dramatic that two men could be working out their feelings of anger. Much more dramatic than showing something of gunfire. I'm constantly concerned about what our children are seeing. And for 15 years, I have tried in this country and Canada to present what I feel is a meaningful expression of care.
Do you narrate it?
I'm the host, yes. And I do all the puppets, and I write all the music, and I write all the scripts.
Well, I'm supposed to be a pretty tough guy, and this is the first time I've had goosebumps for the last 2 days.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and in this season of Mr. Rogers' documentaries and biopics, we are asking what Fred Rogers and his show meant to you then or means to you now. 816-235-2888. That number again, 816-235-2888. And, you know, I get a little bit teary just even hearing that music. I want to bring in Angie Simmons on this. She's the Vice President of Education and Engagement at KCPT. Hi, Angie.
Hi, Gina.
As someone who thinks critically about education and the effects of programming on really young viewing audiences, is there something about Mr. Rogers' show that stands out to you?
You know, it's funny because I was thinking about, you know, I grew up in rural Iowa in the 70s, so I'm a first-generation Mr. Rogers watcher. And I don't think that, you know, as a kid, you sit down and think, I'm learning empathy and I'm learning, you know, these social-emotional skills and tolerance. But, you know, that's what Mr. Rogers did for so many generations of children. And I think when I look at, you know, being a mother and having now a child that's 14 and 12, so not in that age bracket anymore, but you realize the importance of children's programming, and because our kids are watching TV, and if they're going to watch it, don't you want them to be watching something that is instilling those really great skills?
You know, one of the interviewees in the documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, says that if you take everything we know about what makes good TV and do the opposite, you get Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. It was slow paced, it was low production values, it had an unlikely star, but it worked. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. You know, I think it's funny when you think about like what makes a really good TV show or what makes a really good radio show. And I think, you know, if you work in public media, you know that that's not always a lots of bells and whistles. And of course, Mr. Rogers was launching his show in 68 when there really wasn't a lot of bells and whistles to begin with. But
he had more at his disposal than he used, for sure.
Right. And he continued to maintain that format even into the 2000s. I mean, he could have, right? He could have, you know, he could have reinvented his set. He could have, you know, could have gotten a new aquarium. You know, we could have gotten fancier puppets, all those things. But I think at the heart of it, that wasn't his mission, right? His mission wasn't to show off, like, what's the most fancy broadcast I can put together, but more to, like, show the viewers at home that they were special, that they cared. And, you know, Mr. Rogers was not an early childhood expert, but somewhere in all of that, he created a show that focuses on all the things that early childhood experts talk about now, is those nice pauses, making sure that kids feel like they're heard. You know, that's a really important part of early childhood development, is knowing that my voice matters as a kid and that I can speak up, and that, you know, those pauses that he would create and put into his shows, like, those were for children to respond to him at home. And they felt like they were heard. And that's what helped you feel like you were special, is that he was asking you that question, right? And taking the time to listen.
It does seem, just from the little bit of sort of childhood development stuff that I read as a parent, it does seem like some very new trends are things that right now that right. we, you know, really current childhood development research is informing those. And he was doing this stuff before people had that. At least it seems to me.
Yeah. And I think that's what's so amazing is we talk about now, like the what media our kids can consume and how much media that they're faced with. And, you know, as a parent, that's really hard to make those decisions. Like, what do I do? You know, how many hours, you know, how, what's the screen time? What should it look like? And it is hard. And I think, you know, probably, I don't think my parents realized how lucky they were that my screen time was Mr. Rogers and not say something that I'm not going to throw out any name to be insulting, but, you know, they had that fortunate, you know, here's a production that I can feel safe with. And I think that, you know, his legacy does continue with lots of different kinds of programming now that you'll see. And I do think that that's something we hear about. I mean, we know that kids that are most socially and emotionally developed are ready for school. They're ready for those things that are harder or seemingly harder, like math and literacy. Right. And so getting that head start with social emotional skills is so important.
You know, he's in an interview in this documentary, he says with a certain sadness, I would say, that we value children for what they will be and that what they will be is consumers. Is that, would you say that public television programming is still kind of cutting against the grain in that way? Because we can think of this as, oh, wasn't this a more innocent time? But it sounds like, no, this was an exception even then.
Yeah, I don't think, I think if, and especially for folks who've watched the film, he was going up against the same things we're going up against, just maybe at a smaller level. You know, we were still trying to sell to kids, you know, even in the 70s, in the 60s and 70s. And I think that's some, that's the longstanding, you know, he, you know, Mr. Rogers is a pioneer in public television, but that's a longstanding vision and mission that PBS Kids has stuck with for all these generations is that we will treat children as people. We won't treat them as consumers. We're not trying to sell them the next item or game or video game. And we don't need to. They don't need to be sold to. They're not ready to be sold to. And we can do better. We can be better. And I think, you know, when Mr. Rogers testified, we heard that clip, it's like he's saying, like, we can be better. And that's why we need to support this, you know, this public medium so that we can continue to share that, that the good word. And, you know, as a minister, I love that that's where he chose to put his ministry, right, into children's television. And honestly, PBS Kids programming today carries on a lot of his values and mission.
I want to get back to that with you, but I also, you know, there's something, too, about seeing a man stand in front of a group of kids and say feelings are mentionable and manageable. And that is, you know, he's quoted again and again as saying that. That seems to be really like his mantra in a way. And that idea as sort of forward thinking is one thing, but also just even, you know, when I was growing up in the 80s, that was not feelings are mentionable and manageable. I can't, it's hard for me to imagine the grown men in my life at that time standing up in front of people and saying that.
Right. Because if you were a boy, you were heard, don't cry, you know, suck it up, you know, these kinds of things. And then on the flip side, you turn on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and you hear, it's okay to be mad. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to cry. And, you know, what do we do with those feelings? And do we stomp our feet? You know, you can, like, if you could sing the song, I can't sing, so I won't. But, you know, what do we do with the mad that we feel? I mean, that's a song that Mr. Rogers, you know, sang out to that audience. And it gets back to allowing for those pauses, right? He sang it to you and you believed he was singing it to you, you know, that all of a sudden you're like, well, Mr. Rogers just told me it's okay for me to be mad. But I need to sort of express that in a, you know, constructive way. That's probably not exactly what was going through your head as a 4 or 5 year old.
No.
But you knew that you could at least stomp your feet and that was okay.
But you bring up another interesting point that he wasn't speaking to you in a language that you wouldn't have thought in as a 4 year old. Right. What do you do with the mad that you feel is a 4 year old's language?
Exactly, exactly. And that's exactly what he was doing, is that he took all these things that we can put big jargon against now and we know is changing, you know, the way that our kids start to learn. And he brought it down to the level of a 4 or 5, you know, 6 year old. And it worked. I mean, it absolutely worked.
Let's talk with one of our callers at 816-235-2888. We've got Claire in Olathe on the line. Hi, Claire.
Hi, thanks for having me. I was just listening. I listen to your show often, and Mr. Rogers is very important to me and my family. I remember watching it as a child, but more so, I'm watching it now in another form in Daniel Tiger with my own children. And I've been a teacher a lot longer than I've been a mother. I've taught high school for going into my 12th year, and I have a 3.5-year-old and a 1.5-year-old. And just looking at the landscape of the way our world is right now, it just really feels like, you know, we are hungry for empathy. You know, so much of what I see my students going through, I teach high school, and what it seems like kids are struggling with is a lack of empathy. And becoming so digitized in our lives, we seem to lose that connection with people. And, you know, Mr. Rogers was a great way to do that. And Daniel Tiger, the lessons and the little mnemonic device songs, you know, we've been able to help our kids. You know, I don't know how much they understand quite yet, but it's powerful. And I haven't gotten to see the new documentary yet. I have toddlers. We don't go to the movies very much, but he's very much present in our family and in our lives. We have Daniel Tiger on, you know, for a limited amount of time every day. And our son in particular, he's on the spectrum, and it's really hard for him to understand feelings. And we use the songs from Mr. Rogers to help him understand his world. And it just seems that so many children, regardless of where they are neurologically, understanding feelings, I think, is a super huge part of becoming more human. And so, that was kind of just all I wanted to say.
Claire, I do want to follow up with you a little bit, though, because I am sure we have listeners who do not have small children and have not seen Daniel Tiger. And so Daniel Tiger is the first puppet.
Yes, Daniel Tiger would be Mr. Rogers. Yeah, for Mr. Rogers when it was the Children's Corner.
Yeah, and so, but the whole puppet thing was because film reels broke and the live host had to quickly do something. So he grabbed this random tiger.
Yeah, so he'd gotten that as a gift, I think like the week before or something. And it was just like popped it through the, you know, backdrop and
yeah, this
and
little
Tiger's
raggedy
born.
Stuffed animal looking puppet who was on through the rest of the show. The theory is kind of that tiger is Mr. Rogers.
Right.
So now Daniel Tiger has his own animated show that is in the spirit of Mr. Rogers. The pace does feel more today's pace.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And Claire, so for you, you said that your son who is on the spectrum uses these songs to help him kind of learn about feelings. Can you give an example of a lyric that has been really useful?
Well, there's one song, especially anger, I think is very difficult because it's so hard to express that, especially if you don't understand it. And so we use the song, when you feel so mad, you want to roar, take a deep breath and count to four. And we do that a lot. And now we just talk about taking a deep breath when you're mad. But that kind of has grown out of him seeing those characters, experiencing those feelings, and, you know, and then understanding that sometimes what he does makes his younger sister mad or sad. And just, but that song in particular stands out to me because my husband and I memorized that one very quickly. And it's been, I think, the most present one. And I think that anger anger, I think, is a replacement for a lot more complex emotions for him. You know, he doesn't understand when he's sad. He doesn't understand when he makes other people sad. And that song is mainly about taking a break. And we, you know, I think parents of all young children need to take a break with them sometimes. And it's helpful for us, too, to remember that we're mad because he's mad. And so we should all take a deep breath and count to four.
Well, thank you so much, Claire.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So, Angie Jennings, I mean, you are with KCPT right now, and I'm curious about how the legacy of some of these ideas in Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood is being, how those ideas are being translated today into programming, what works about it and what maybe you can't quite hang on to.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is like there's really never going to be another man specifically like Mr. Rogers, you know, and I think Mr. Rogers would want it that way. He told us all we're unique and we're special in our own ways, right? And so he was, but he certainly, as I mentioned, his legacy continues and shows today. Now, yes, Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood does have a little bit, you know, it's an animated series, and certainly the pace is a little bit more up to date with what you might see, kids watching, but it still does take that time, and it still is in reinforcing all of those social emotional values for kids, that empathy that we heard the caller talk about. And, you know, that those are we still use the music. The music was so important to Mr. Rogers and important to kids, that they, have songs and lyrics that help them kind of like work through those different emotions. And I think at the very core, Mr. Rogers was looking for, how can I make sure that, children feel special and loved, but that they're ready to go on into the world, and that they're ready to, in our case now, we're talking about preschoolers being ready for school, right? And how do we make sure that they're ready? One of those ways is ensuring that their developmental skills are on par with other kids. And I think one of the things that he cared so much about was, are we looking at, our high needs kids that maybe don't have access to, parents that are giving them that kind of love. Well, then we know that if they're going to be watching TV, if they're going to watch some kind of show, then PBS programming starts with that sort of curriculum first. Every show that PBS Kids works on, it's curriculum based. And so all the research that maybe didn't necessarily go into Mr. Rogers initially, all that research goes into every single PBS Kids show, so that you do know that you're sitting your kid down in front of something that has an education focus on it. But we can't avoid the entertainment factor, right? I mean, kids also need to be entertained. And I don't think Mr. Rogers would say he wasn't entertaining kids either. I mean, I think he'd be honest about that and say, sure, I'm entertaining, but I also want to make sure you're getting something out of this and that it's valuable, and it's valuable for that a limited amount of time that you're going to be watching media.
I want to quickly talk to you about some big moments that Mr. Rogers addressed in sort of like social in American history, and thinking about how kids were experiencing those moments, like Kennedy's assassination, and something I remember really clearly, the Challenger exploding shortly after takeoff. Like, kids across the country were watching the television when that happened. They had been, this had been really built up for them, and especially the teacher being on that. That was a crazy moment in television. That he actively addressed these things on his show. He said in this documentary that it was a plea to parents and other adults not to isolate children in these moments.
I do think that gets back to like treating kids as people, not, we don't lie to our children. We're honest with them. I mean, that's what made him so authentic, is that we address problems so that they know how to deal with them later. It doesn't do us any good to not talk about the Vietnam War when it's happening around you and your uncle or your dad or your brother is off to war. You need someone to talk to you about that. And I think that was sort of the beauty of him addressing those kinds of things. And I love that he did. And I think, PBS Kids tries to do that still today. Daniel Tiger and many of our other PBS Kids shows look for that kind of talking to kids honestly and treating them as people.
We're going to be right back to this conversation at 816-235-2888. Tell us your thoughts about Fred Rogers, his show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, or content aimed at kids and how it's changed over generations. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we are talking about Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, your neighbor. And I'm here with Angie Simmons. She's with us from KCPT. And Angie, what about that whole idea of neighborhood?
Well, I think that, the neighborhood for Mr. Rogers included, you had Handyman Negri and you had, Mr. McFeely. And but it also included just being curious about your surroundings and learning about things. I mean, there's nothing more exciting than like when Mr. Rogers went to Picture-Picture, right? And then you got to go and, watch a crayon get made or, whatever that was, and how fun that was. Or when you went to the, and music store and you learned about jazz. I mean, what kid knew about jazz? But any kid who grew up with Mr. Rogers did, right?
And then they were all right there in the neighborhood, though.
They were all there. Everybody was there in the neighborhood. And I think, in worlds that have gotten so big, it's hard to imagine that all that's in your neighborhood now. But I think that it did sort of explore this idea of curiosity and what that meant. But I think the other part of the being in that neighborhood was the tolerance and accepting nature that Mr. Rogers had. We had in the you know, 60s and 70s, we had the character Francois Clemens, of Officer Clemens, and the sharing of the waiting pool between an African-American man and a white man during a time of really awful, you know, strife and protest. And so I think he went beyond just like what you think about the neighborhood and like really expanded it out to like, this neighborhood is bigger than ourselves sometimes. And sometimes that you may not have known all the different kinds of people and places that were on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, but you did after you watched an episode.
Let's talk to Jill in Kansas City, Missouri at 816-235-2888. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Gina. I'm a retired preschool teacher and pediatric nurse. And in the late 80s, I had my own preschool. By that time, I was familiar with Mr. Rogers on PBS because I had watched him with my kids when they were little. I incorporated Mr. Rogers' songs, I used his albums, his lessons in my curriculum almost daily. My college preschool curriculum emphasized the learning of social skills for preschoolers, not academics, and Mr. Rogers' message fit in perfectly with what I had already learned. He was my invisible right-hand man or teacher without his permission. I don't think he would have minded. And I immediately recognized the value of his catchy, upbeat songs and his lyrics. As you mentioned, the picture, the things he presented on his shows were valuable for adults. I was often mesmerized and also learned from what he presented on his shows through his puppets and his different presentations. So he taught adults, and he taught me as well, but I did use him in my preschool.
Well, thank you, Jill, for that call. And, you know, while we are on the topic of his songs and his lyrics, I want to play one of the better-known ones. Just maybe you've never heard it, or maybe you haven't heard it in a long time. I find it really poignant. We're going to listen to this catchy tune.
I like you as you are. Exactly and precisely, I think you turned out nicely, and I like you as you are. I do. I like you as you are, without a doubt or question, or even a suggestion, 'cause I like you as you are. I like your disposition, your facial composition.
You know, it is. So much of being an adult who is teaching children is telling them what they're not supposed to do. And he seems like he was kind of sensitive to how that might translate to a kid.
Yeah, no, and that song's so beautiful. I mean, and it, you know, as you get into hearing all those lyrics, he's telling you it's not, he gets into details. Like, I like your face. I like everything about you. And so, you know, kids that are dealing with, he brought in Jeffrey Erlanger, remember, with the boy in the wheelchair, and it's like he likes him just the way he is, and like the pride on that little boy's face when you see that episode is so touching. But I have to imagine that that's the feeling that kids across the country were feeling when they were watching that show, that they found themselves in that song, they were able to identify with it. And, you know, kind of referring to the caller, it's like it's so nice to hear her say that she used those lessons in her classroom, and that's a lot of what KCBT does with these shows now, is making sure that all of these lessons are accessible to preschools around Kansas City and other, you know, cities across the country, that these are lessons that you can use in your classroom. And it doesn't have to just be, you don't have to sit your kid down in front of it, but then like expand on that. And I think that's what Mr. Rogers' pauses were for too, is just to let you kind of like think about what he was saying and doing, and hopefully that emulated in your life later, right?
Let's talk to Sonia in Gladstone. Hi, Sonia.
Hi, Gina. I just love your show. I can tell you, when I first heard of Mr. Rogers, I was 17. And I remember his voice. His voice was soothing. His voice was calming. And when I moved to California eventually, and I had a young man I put under my wing. His mother was a heroin addict. He never knew his father. And on the day that Mr. Rogers died, it was in 2003. And he came to the library where I was working part-time, and he just cried in my arms. And I said, what? And I didn't have to ask him. I knew that he liked Mr. Rogers, because Mr. Rogers was like a father to him. And this guy was like a, he was a rapper and an excellent dancer. But Mr. Rogers was like his surrogate father. And I can tell you, I have tears in my eyes right now just thinking about him. I will get the DVD once they put it out of the documentary on Mr. Rogers. And thank you for your program.
Well, you know, Sonia, thank you for that call. And the idea that Mr. Rogers had a not just a TV relationship with the kids, but that this was a relationship was one that you learn in the documentary he understood and took seriously.
Yeah, you know, we've been celebrating his anniversary this whole year at KCPT, we have been talking to people, much like you're doing today on the show, about like how Mr. Rogers impacted their lives. And you wouldn't believe the number just here in Kansas City. So then imagine that multiplied over the country of people who said, I wrote a letter to Mr. Rogers and he wrote back. And, you know, I met Mr. Rogers and we carried on a relationship, you know, over years, and people that he became friends with, you know, he was still friends with Senator John Pastor late in life. And this was someone that he went up against and testified against. So I think people, his ability to connect with individuals was really at the heart of like that show too. So like, even if you hadn't met him, you felt like you had, because you felt that, that connection with him. But I love hearing the stories of individuals who wrote him letters and that he wrote back to, or even that the mother who talked about having a, you know, a child on the spectrum, that was something he cared a lot about, as kids that maybe had some special needs. And if there was something he could do to make that child feel better or happier or more accepted, that he wanted to do that. And what a great way to live, like, if we could all be so kind.
His son in the movie says, you know, his dad never forgot what it was like to be 6 and 7 and 8, mm-hmm. and that was a big part of what gave him that ability. But he, it's interesting, you know, when you talk about special needs, he grew up very sick himself, is another thing you learn.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, and maybe that was part of why he chose television as his medium, right? He knew that he could be out into the living rooms of children and they that maybe couldn't get to see him somewhere else. I mean, if he had put on a stage show, how limited would that have been? Or even if he had stuck with his ministry, again, how limited that would have been. But he chose a medium that allowed him to be in every single living room across the country and speak to every kid, including those kids who probably needed him the most.
We have some tweets that I want to share, and then I also want to get back to our callers at 816-235-2888. We have one tweet, and this one is interesting to me. Quint says, watching the Mr. Rogers movie, I look at the children absorbing his message and realizing they are now adults with power. And I wonder why public discourse is so toxic today.
Oh, I know. I mean, and I think as you watch that movie, towards the end of it, you really started to see some of Mr. Rogers' politics and his activism come out, you know, and even his own frustration with politics. And
that he hadn't changed the world.
That he hadn't changed the world. And maybe that was slightly disappointing to him that, you know, with all of this talk of love and liking yourself and liking others and being accepting, that still he couldn't quite completely crack the nut. And I mean, I guess the response to the person who tweeted is that I wonder that too. And I do think that that's why shows like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and now PBS's Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood are so needed. Our kids need to understand empathy and need to understand kindness and what it means to treat somebody kindly. And that I think Mr. Rogers did that one kid at a time in a weird kind of way. And we all felt it if we watched it. And
but it was also not necessarily the primary message that people were receiving elsewhere.
Exactly. And you can't really control all of the environment around you, but you can control what you'd say to a kid and hope that some of that sticks, right? You can't, it's a utopia that he didn't reach either.
And Sam tweets us, he says, the Fred Rogers documentary in theaters now is a must-see. Indeed, I'd send every early childhood teacher and daycare worker to see it if I were king. little King Friday fantasy there.
There we go. Well, Ed, I think that's probably true. Maybe that's just a nice outing for all the early childhood providers in the city to go and do. But I think that if you need a reminder of what you do as an early childhood provider and like the value that you're providing to children, then maybe this helps you a little bit. And I know that, you know, we talked a little bit about like there's no one quite like Mr. Rogers, but people that were influenced by him that have become now early childhood educators because of that, like, I think that's lovely. And his mission certainly continues with those kinds of teachers.
Let's talk to Roseanne at 816-235-2888. There's still a tiny bit of time if you have a comment on this that you need to get in here. 816-235-2888. Roseanne in Prairie Village, good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to echo what you said. When I was a mother of preschoolers, I would sit down with them and watch it with them and put my arm around each one, and we'd listen and we'd sing along. And during the day, we would remember the songs and sing them. And it was a very meaningful time for us, and it let me just take a break and give them some hugs and a point of reference during the day. If something came up that was troubling, you know, we could just start singing, you know, "Won't You Be My Neighbor," or "I Like You As You Are," or, you know, whatever fit the situation. And he was very helpful. I wish everyone could use that with their children.
Thank you, Roseanne. You know, something that we haven't talked about that really was poignant to me in this movie was I had not known that when he came back on the air after his hiatus, that was driven by a really kind of small but significant epidemic of kids who had not understood in the Superman movie that you can't just jump off a roof with the cape, you know, really terrible incidents. And he quickly got the show back on the air to explain the difference between real and make-believe.
Yeah, he had thought he was kind of done. You know, he'd produced all of these episodes, and I can't imagine, because those would have been the episodes I grew up on, but then we would have missed all these other episodes and all these other generations, right? But he did. He saw there was, like, right with that Superman, but it does get to him thinking, like, this is what we're showing our kids. We're showing them things that aren't real, that we're not being honest with them. And, yeah, there was this crazy moment of kids being injured and hurt, and so he addressed that face on. Like, watch me jump off the step, right? And like, I'm not going to fly. I can't fly. And then he took you to the neighborhood of make-believe and reinforced that. And it seems like such a simple message, like trying to tell your kid, like, you can't fly. But our kids believe what we tell them. You know, if you tell them that, you know, Superman can jump out of a building, then if nobody tells you that's not possible, then maybe you believe that it is. And I think that's when Mr. Rogers realized he had so much more to share, is that kids need to know a lot of things. They need to know about what's going on around them, but they also need to know about things that seem so simple to us as adults, but maybe not so simple when you're 4 or 5.
I want to bring in one more caller. We've got Elizabeth in Parkville on the line. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Just a minute, let me take you off speakerphone.
Okay. She's following instructions.
Yes.
I never do this. So. Hi, Elizabeth. Hi. I just wanted to say, my son and his, what year did Mr. Rogers die?
2003.
I beg your pardon? 2003?
Yes.
Okay. My son was 36, and he called me with this little boy voice and said, "Mom, have you heard the news?" And I said, "What news, son?" And he said, "Mr. Rogers died." And I was so sorry. And because he was one of those kids that would sit right in front of the TV and answer all the questions and ask Mr. Rogers to be his neighbor. And it was just for weeks after that, everything that was in the paper about him, he sent me.
Do you
anything he saw online?
Do you see in your son the results of that experience he had, that relationship he had with Fred Rogers?
Yes. He doesn't always allow himself to show the softer sides, but he does have them. He's now 40, 41. And he still will, every once in a while something will come up and he'll say, "Hey, Mom, did you hear about this or did you hear about that?" And he was definitely my son's best friend for many, many years.
That's sweet. Thank you, Elizabeth. And Angie, you met Mr. Rogers.
I did. And, you know, you mentioned him, his passing. I remember crying, which seems like such a crazy thing to do when it's a celebrity. But I did meet him. And I was thinking about that encounter and remembering, like, I was really young. I was in my 20s and I'd only been at KCBT for a short amount of time. And I've never been particularly good at meeting my heroes. I came incredibly tongue-tied and I probably rambled on much longer than I intended to do. And but he, if you wondered, was he like that in real life? He was, because he was so patient and so quiet and so attentive to my ramble. And I was telling him about how I loved the neighborhood of make-believe and that it was part of what made me want to be a storyteller, and that I used to tell stories in my backyard with my best friends and we'd recreate the neighborhood. But it wasn't very eloquent. And his response was just very calm and quiet. And he's like, "Imagination is so important, even as we're adults." And I just thought, you're right, it is. Like, so to continue to be imaginative, you know, that's one of those messages he gave me.
And he liked you just the way you were.
And he did like me just the way I am. And you all out there, too.
Angie Simmons, thanks so much for joining me from KCPT today.
Thank you.
Angie is the Vice President of Education and Engagement for KCPT. Up next, women's reform movements of the late 19th and early 20th century have been thoroughly studied in other cities, but Kansas City's a little different. We'll hear why. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now David Hanslick is here with me. He's the Director of Programming and Development for Sheffield Place, a facility for homeless mothers and children in the Kansas City area. And he just wrote a book about the history of women's activism in Kansas City. It's called Benevolence, Moral Reform, Equality, and it focuses on the years from 1870 to 1940. David Hanslick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gina.
The words benevolence, equality, and moral reform represent three typically separate strands of women's activism, but you say they weren't separate in Kansas City. Can you explain the strands, first of all, and what usually did keep them separate?
Sure. Generally, the three strands of women's activism, benevolence, moral reform, and equality, were based on socioeconomic status and to some extent on religion. The benevolent women were those who wanted to provide relief to the poor. The moral reformers wanted to take the wrongs of society, prostitution, for example, and eliminate it. And the women who were advocating—
And drinking was a big one too, right?
And drinking, absolutely. And the women who were promoting equality were those who wanted women to be treated as equals in society. So in most cities, these women were separate, have formed separate organizations. But in Kansas City in 1870, they formed one organization and provided activities that met the needs of all three.
What do you think accounts for that?
Well, I think that Kansas City is unique. Kansas City is a border city, and it was formed out of the experience of the Civil War. People tended to get along. They had a high amount of civility. People who held differing opinions would work together.
That's not how I've heard the interactions across this border typically described, but maybe that's because you start in 1870.
Well, in the founding period of Kansas City, the social and economic elites held varying opinions. The Coates, for example, were abolitionist Quakers. The Lycans were pro-slavery people. But they got along and they worked together to make sure that the community progressed economically. Economic progress was their highest value. And it's because of that civility and working together that they were able to get the Hannibal Bridge, which opened in 1869 and led to the explosion of population in Kansas City. And it's that working together that also, I believe, in a small city, caused the women to come together across denominational and philosophical lines to form an organization.
What was the name of that organization?
It was the Women's Christian Association, and it still, in fact, exists in Kansas City.
You say that this went across lines. Did it include women from outside the Christian faith, or?
Well, the Women's Christian Association, in keeping with the ecumenical nature of Kansas City, the members themselves were Protestant. They, however, received support from the Catholic community and the Jewish community in a very, very interesting, again, ecumenical civility, people working together, particularly at the elite levels.
So looking at Kansas City at this time, I mean, the beginning point at 1870, I would say that sounds like this is the emerging from the Civil War is kind of the launching point for this. But what is it about this moment that sets the stage for so much activity in women's activism?
Well, Kansas City was growing. Kansas City, because of the Hannibal Railroad Bridge, became a transportation center. Kansas City had more railroad lines coming into it than any other city except Chicago. So Kansas City was very much in the mix of national trends, very much in the mix of national intellectual developments. And that's what provided a forum, an opportunity for women in Kansas City to be very much engaged with national organizations and to, in some cases, lead them, and in other cases, be national board members.
There are several specific women in this book and specific accomplishments. I'm curious if you could share a little bit about Josephine Cylon Yates.
Yes, Josephine Cylon Yates is a wonderful example of a leader from Kansas City. She was an African-American woman. She graduated first in her high school class at age 16 in Rhode Island. She came out here after university to teach at the Lincoln Institute, which became Lincoln University in Jefferson City. She married W.W. Yates, who is a well-known educator, and there's, I believe, still an elementary school in the Kansas City, Missouri School District named after W.W. Yates. Josephine Cylon Yates was active in the Women's Club movement among African-American women.
What is the Women's Club movement?
Well, the Women's Club movement was a huge movement in the country. General Federation of Women's Clubs was founded in the 1890s. They provided an outlet for activism and civic education for women. They were so popular, in fact, these clubs, that in the Kansas City newspapers, they would have two full pages of meeting notices for the women's clubs. So Josephine Cylon Yates was active within the African-American Women's Club movement. She, in 1901, was elected as the president of the National Association of Colored Women, beating out such luminaries as Mrs. Booker T. Washington, Margaret Washington. So she was a national figure, a national leader. She was an intimate friend of another nationally known activist, Ida B. Wells, who was an anti-lynching advocate.
What was it about her that really, like, that you think made her such a compelling figure, not just locally, but nationally?
Well, I think she was an exceptional person. She had the leadership skills. She was accomplished in her field. She was well connected within the African American community, and she took advantage of those qualities to lead nationally with the National Association of Colored Women.
What were some of the changes that women achieved in Kansas City during this time period? Something that jumps out to you and maybe even has a lesson for anyone who wants to create any kind of change?
Well, I think the big lessons are to be organized and active and thoughtful about how you progress. There was a woman by the name of a woman who led the Women's Christian Temperance Union, Clara Thompson, who was a national figure in the organization, and she was an intimate friend of Frances Willard, Clara Hoffman, excuse me. They advocated for suffrage in the 1880s, 1890s, the turn of the century, long before it became acceptable. It was a radical notion, and the Women's Christian Temperance Union said, "Let's ban alcohol, but we'll have to have the women. We'll have to have women voting. We'll have to have the right to vote for women in order to have prohibition." So therefore, they advocated voting as a way of gaining prohibition, and they were very effective. They organized themselves. Their districts, for example, were the same as congressional districts across the country. So they were already organized nationally because of their sage strategic logic.
Yeah, it sounds like they didn't start with their end goal. They said, okay, we want people to stop drinking. How are we going to do that? We need women to vote, so let's start there.
Yes, and I think if strategically their big end goal was the vote.
So, you know, the idea of temperance brings me in kind of a weird way to this question of what inspired you to look into this history. Is it in some way related to the work you do with women now, you know, trying to get themselves out of the situation of homelessness here in Kansas City?
Yes, I would say it's all kind of a piece. I've always been interested in how people whom society does not allow to live out their full humanity and their full potential, how those groups of people go about gaining a voice in the public discussion. And I think that is as much the case with women who are financially disadvantaged as well. How do they go about making their way from homelessness to self-sufficiency? So it's a struggle, and it takes strategy, it takes vision, it takes tenacity.
What do you think that, based on your interactions with women who are struggling to find a collective kind of voice today, I mean, what do you think that you brought to this research that maybe you could see certain strands that someone coming from perhaps a more academic perspective might not?
Well, this book kind of walks the line between the popular, I hope it appeals to the popular reader because it has a lot of important things to say. It also brings in the academic side and situates what I'm discussing in Kansas City against the national backdrop of what's happening. So it works to meet both audiences' needs.
Can you talk to me about that national backdrop in this time period, 1870 to 1940?
Yes. I think that the national backdrop is that women were making huge gains. And this is a central point I try to bring out in the work. Women were making huge gains. Women's colleges were being formed. Colleges and universities were being open to women. Oberlin is a prime example of an early men's college that early in the time period was open to women. As a matter of fact, women were represented very well in higher education and the professions, physicians, lawyers, business people. There wouldn't be more women in higher education and the professions again until the 1970s as there were in the 19-teens and 1920s.
Wow.
So women were making huge progress, and that's a history that's forgotten because I think in the popular American mindset, women's equality, feminism, started in the 1960s, where it started well before, a century before, or more before.
Well, or we tend to think of progress as a straight line, and so hearing that in the 19-teens, it would take again until the 1970s for that number of women to be in colleges and universities.
And the professions,
yes. And the professions. What do you think accounts for that middle space?
Well, it is that women, the social construction of femininity changed. There was a reaction against women in the professions. It was viewed as maladjustment. So you had that, then you had the Depression, which caused a whole change of focus. Then you had the post-war consumer culture that caused women to be viewed as homemakers, and that was their role. So they didn't regain a consciousness of themselves as feminists until the 1970s.
Well,
60s and 70s.
Our time is up, but David Hanslick, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina.
David Hanslick has a new book from the University of Missouri Press. It's called Benevolence, Moral Reform, Equality, Women's Activism in Kansas City, 1870 to 1940. And that's a wrap. You can grab this conversation or the one we heard earlier about Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and what that means to people out there at kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you later today. Tomorrow is a food show, a little soda fountain history, and a search for the best frozen treats in town. Today's show was produced by Coy Duggar. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.